Well, hello and welcome to what is the 136th episode of the Adoption and Fostering Podcast, allegedly, with me, Al Coates, and him.
It's Scott Kazan-Rennie.
How the hell are you?
I'm just having a thought there. You said 130, whatever it was. What are we going to do when we're like at 5,365? Are we going to have to say that out loud?
Probably. But yeah, we'll have
or
to do that.
Or will we be dead by then? Who knows?
Who knows?
Possible.
But apparently we just hit our 300th episode milestone last week.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that everything thrown in, like conversations and
yeah,
all that
whole
sort of
shebang.
Yeah,
the whole shebang.
The whole
yeah.
shebang. Well, that's something for our CPD, isn't it?
Yeah, I put that on my CV as well.
Yeah, yeah.
I had to write my CV for something. I was writing the... I've been trying to write with Charlotte Jenkins, a guide for like a quick guide to child parent violence or you know whatever you want to call it, for social workers like a two sides of like here are the things to think about, here just a few steps, and I wrote my little like a paragraph of my CV and Charlotte had written a sentence and I went to Charlotte, oh Charlotte come on, bloomin' heck man you're like your CV is just this accolade after accolade. So she like reluctantly, like really modestly built it up. And then we sent through the first draft and they came back and went, it sounds like you're selling yourselves. Can you just tone that down a bit?
I was going, oh, really?
Sorry, Charlotte.
Yeah, she needed to go back to the sentence, did she?
Yeah, clearly I said, clearly I'm wired differently. That total self-promotion snake oil salesman, you roll up, get your hot potatoes.
Get your broom handles here.
Get your carnival barker, you know, that sort of thing that I'm doing over the internet.
Yes.
Anyway, we're not even... So that's happening. Anyway, no. That's happening. And a lot of things happening around that. Yeah, I spoke to some people yesterday. So we're trying to get a bit of momentum around that because there was the VRU, the Violence Reduction Unit for London, put out a report, which is on... It can be found anywhere. So if you Google Violence Reduction Unit... But anyway, we didn't come on and talk about that, did we, this week?
I don't know. I was just thinking there, it's like I'm catching up with all the stuff that you're doing because I'm kind of out of the loop. But then...
Now, I don't know how to text you anymore.
No, but I get the emails for the little admin errors that you make now and again, you know, like forgetting to point the income from No Borders Training to a bank account. And
just little things.
Yeah, just little, you know, yeah.
Or trifling.
They're fixable.
Trifling. But the money from the first training is now paid for this year's
Zoom, I know.
Which is
yes.
really good.
I know. And our website renewal is due this week.
So. Yeah, no, so I've got another training next week. So I'm like literally... We really should get a sponsor. I'm all
we
for Xanax or Valium. Could you think they would sponsor us? Or?
Oh, it has to be something relevant to us, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm right, I think.
It really does. I mean, we've always joked about bourbons, but I think it's more bourbon than bourbons.
Yeah.
Should be sponsored.
Brought to you by white wine. Chilled white wine. Oh, but obviously, you're off the drink now. Are you allowed?
I've had one glass in the last 7 weeks.
Wow.
And even then, it was like Tris had the air ambulance on standby just in case it did anything.
I have noticed the shakes have gone down a bit.
Yeah. I know, but I think part of that was, I did think about that the other day, actually, because that is a family trait. All of my family have these kind of shakes. But I think a lot of that is due to the fact that I now eat breakfast.
Oh.
That's what I'm pinning it to, because
You've
I had them before.
Eaten
I
breakfast?
Well, no, never, never. Since I was a teen, since I was about the age of 13, I've never eaten breakfast. And I've put it down to that based on the fact that I was a functioning alcoholic. And you know,
oh, we've gone so dark so quick, haven't we? I mean, I thought this was going to be quite a difficult episode, but you've just
you know, put it out there.
Right. And so you're a functioning alcoholic.
Also, yeah, but also you have to remember, nicotine as well is a very bad habit, so don't do it, boys and girls.
Do you really want this episode to go out?
Yeah. Well, I mean, anybody who knows me, like who's met me, will know that I was a smoker. Up until 7-8 weeks ago, whatever it is. And I enjoy a glass of wine or a glass of Prosecco. And the glass of wine or Prosecco enjoyment won't stop just because of this. And, you know, I've been told I can have the odd one now and again. But clearly I can't have quite as much as what I was. And the smoking has gone completely. So And it's funny because I've got a visitor this week and she's a nurse, a carer, she was called her, a nurse, one of her friends from over in England. And she was very kind of, we had a good old chat about the whole jing bang and it was good, great to get it all out of my system. And the reason I'm now waffling is because I forgot what I was going to say, which is one of the side effects of what I got. So let's move on quickly.
I'll keep you on track. Well, how are your kids doing? Because my kid, you know, how in the world of adoption, we are an adoption fostering podcast. Any how are your kids? How are the kids doing?
Yes. Two of them passed the driving test last week.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. They're both over the age of the age that they can actually drive. So that was good.
It's totally legal and everything. They didn't buy their driving tests.
What else? I think it's safe to say that we've had a tricky one. We've been we had to have the police out a couple of weeks ago. And we've now been referred to the TUSTLA, which is a children's kind of thing. So we're waiting on the phone call from them to go through that. So yes, it's fabulous. We've had a really lovely couple of weeks, generally.
Same old, apart from that.
Yeah. But do you know what? It's like, you know, peaks and troughs, you take the rough with the smooth. Every so often these things happen. And I think we're just so used to it now that we're kind of, you know, almost just like accepting of it in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because I am on lots of Facebook groups, different adopted, you know, people at different places in adoption and their experience of adoption. All of them are exclusively UK, like, context. And just interesting sort of feeling like slightly, there's this group of people who are, their children are quite little and just, you don't want to be the cynical old person going, oh, look at that. I don't want any of that, you know, which I'd resist because I hate when people did that to me.
It's almost quite patronising, isn't it?
It is patronising, and it's not cast in stone. You know, there's risks and there's not risks, and, you know, and there's no, you know, where, you know, my 16-year-old is a character, and she's doing okay. She's, you know, it's good days and bad days. We're having a bit of a wobble. I'm not sure, I'm kind of nervous around talking too much about my children's welfare, but you know, she's. But one of my children is looking into their files, which has been
interesting. Okay.
Which is kind of they're digging out their files or about to request files, and well, that's a complicated conversation. Have you any of your children ever accessed files? Because our children have, and older ones have. Any interest?
No, and none at all. And it's interesting because we've always been. Well, we've always had to be very open about everything, obviously, because, you know, it's not every day you have two dads, is it, who live in the same roof and sleep in the same bed. And I don't think that's biologically possible even now. But what I find fascinating is even later life letters, not even an interest in those. You know, obviously that's for anyone who's listening who doesn't know, they're written for when they're older. And they're supposed to be written at, you know, again, age appropriately, aren't they? So for the age of 18 or thereabouts, whenever you think that your child should kind of be given them. But no interest, they still sit in the cupboard.
You know, we've never had later life letters.
Have you not?
No. I know we're supposed to have later life letters, but I guess that's a bit of advice. If you're at that stage of, if you miss that moment, the social worker's gone. You'll never get them.
Yeah.
We missed the moment for whatever reason.
That's interesting. But but there's been no interest about the kind of file side. I mean, there's been contact, social media contact, should we say, which is reverted into kind of messaging on whatever message app they use with them, with sister, brother, aunts. But nothing. In fact, I'm not even sure whether. We've never not told them that they could access their files, but I don't think we've ever kind of discussed the fact that they could access their files, if that makes sense.
Right. It's always been a really open sort of conversation with our children. And I think that we always took the view, because I presume you've got copies of child permanence reports?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, so our view is always that, you know, you can see them when you're older. And the complication of having siblings is that you don't want one, you know, there's all like, one's going to be 18, one's going to be 14. And if you tell one, how can you not tell you this? We always kind of, we sort of just said, look, we're going to wait till you're 18. But our commitment to them always was that we would tell them everything that we knew was in there.
Yeah.
So that there'd be no, like, there'd be no, revelation moment, or like, you know, I can't think of a ridiculous kind of revelation. You read your files and discover that you're not, this wasn't what you thought. So everything was full disclosure. And we would fill in all the gaps, all the details, all the kind of the decision-making processes and major events. But I remember when I'm sure my eldest daughter, she's now 28, at 18, sort of sitting down, reading her CPR child permanency report, that she sobbed her heart out.
Really?
Absolutely sobbed her heart out. And I sort of, like, you know, sensitively, unusually for me, said, just, you know, what's going on, you know, because there's not, she said, you're right, there's nothing in here that's like a revelation.
Right.
She said, but just seeing me on paper, is just, there was a visceral reaction. And it made me think that, wow, if the stuff in there that you didn't know, and there was any revelations, that would just be overwhelming. How do you manage that?
Yeah, that's very true, actually.
But none of my children have gone and got their records, you know, because that is the CPR, but that's not the case notes. In theory, you could go and get you could go and get a blow-by-blow account of, you know, went to visit family on this day, this happened.
Yeah.
They might be redacted, though.
Yeah, I think they probably would be, because even, I mean, I remember seeing some kind of forms and documents when, bearing in mind, part of a large sibling group that didn't come to us. So a lot of the kind of names and the stuff was kind of redacted from those. So yeah, you're right. And I think that's wrong, because, you know, if they're a part of the same family and they've had the same kind of experiences, then they shouldn't really be redacted. Not sure. I mean, see some people who've had their files on social media, and, you know, they sometimes post a photograph and they're quite heavily redacted. And I don't see, you know, it's wrong, because that is part of their story.
Well, yeah, I mean, but I don't know. But I mean, we've got six children who are all parts of sibling groups. Three, you know, but even the CPRs, it's difficult, because I think that you can imagine in the cut and thrust of social work that you've got three CPRs, which are huge documents to produce. My three eldest children who've got this kind of narrative that they were in foster care together and they came and moved into us, but their stories were not the same, just non-comparable. But there's so much cut and paste out of that. And one, you know, that the eldest CPR is markedly different to the youngest and their experiences. Mm-hmm. I just think it's a, but the other children are not particularly bothered. Some of them are not bothered. I just think it's interesting. I'd recommend that you just keep hold of every bit of paper that comes across.
I know, I mean, like, we have moved, well, what have we moved? Three times since 2007. And literally, we have about three or four boxes just full of paperwork that we keep, because it's not ours to get rid of. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's not our story. We've got like a little A4 envelope in there with our... we were a Form F lot, so our Form F.
For me?
No, Form F. Form F when we first did it.
I'm not going to follow you. Yeah, Form A for adoption. But then you became foster carers, and you've done a Form F when you became a foster carer.
Yeah, so we had a Form E and a Form F then, rather than the prospective adopters report. But that's a very small part of those boxes, do you know what I mean? The rest of it is the kids' stories and their lives, and, you know, it's there for them. They know where it is. They know when to look at it, you know, and a lot of it is kind of EHCP stuff and, you know, medical reports, like when one went in to get grommets in hospital and all that sort of stuff. But it's all in there. That's their stuff. That's nothing, you know, that's not for us to kind of go through and thin out or even to throw away. So, it's a...
I mean, I've started to scan everything we get and just put it into a Dropbox folder that the kids have access to their own Dropbox folder, because just respectfully would suggest that...
With six of them?
Yeah.
That's a lot of boxes of paper.
That's a lot of boxes of paper. But also, I'm really conscious of my children's... There's a callousness, can be a callousness about youth, you know, just in general, is that like, oh, it's fine, and it's gone. If you lose it, it's gone, or it's ripped, it's gone. Yeah. So scan the damn thing, and then it's forever. Keep the physical copy.
Yeah, that's true.
But just conscious of this stuff that... And I think it matters more, doesn't it, as you get older? I mean, I think, when you're sort of in your 20s, I don't know, sometimes that stuff isn't that as important, but maybe as you get older, exactly. Your own children, yeah. It might become more pertinent. Yeah. Anywho, I'll tell you what I'm up to this week. This is you're talking about how things are going. My 10-year-old, she who is an avid fan of TikTok, with very tight restrictions on, so we've talked about my TikTok dancing, which, like, I got a message off.
You call it dancing?
Well, you know, it's like falling with style. My 16-year-old, I got a text off for going, you need to remove everything from TikTok now. My friends have found it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
no. So I didn't.
clearly. Why would you?
And then, what's her face? The 10-year-old. She got into, like, there's this water bottle where it's got marks on, so it's like a 2-litre water bottle. And I said, look, you're 10 years old and you've seen it. She has to wear heavy shoes in the wind because
she'll blow over. Yeah.
So she said, no, I want it. And I said, well, it's your money, you can buy it. So she bought this 2-litre bottle of water. And you can't believe the fun I've had, because she's like, right, I'm going to drink 2 litres of water today. And we checked and it was like, for her age, 1.5 litres is all fine. So she set herself off. But she would leave the water bottle everywhere and I would keep topping it up.
Evil man.
And she was like, but not enough so that it wasn't going down, but it was just going down very, very slowly. Right. And Paula she couldn't cope in the end. But honestly, the poor girl, she was like, she was sloshing as she was walking around the house and she spent the whole day on the toilet. Oh, that's the kind of fun you can't buy, isn't it? And she was going, did you really do that? I was going, yeah, I did do that.
See, that's mean. And I mean, I have to drink a lot of water at the minute. And I'm now at the 3-litre level every day.
Wow. Hardcore.
But I'm glad I don't live with you. But if I did, then I do have my 500ml bottle, which I top up because I don't drink water. I drink squash, which I've been told is fine because I'm not a lover of tap water. And I'm told that's fine. So I count based on those, not on what's in the big bottle, you see.
And that would be double as a weapon looking at it.
Yeah, no, it's like a bullet. It's a bit like your one, actually, but mine's is colourful.
Oh, yes, I do love mine. I have such a strong... I can't believe we're talking about water bottles. I think we're putting off the crux of this week's podcast because it's so bloody
maybe.
Horrible.
Yeah,
one of my favourite memories of going to DfE is when I scratched on the bottom of my water bottle MBE and I showed it to you in the meeting and you...
Yes.
Without
nearly
anyone
myself.
Seeing... Nearly wet yourself, and then you were kicking me under the table, and we were like naughty schoolboys at the DfE, giggling in the corner.
Yes,
no coincidence, we don't get invited back very often.
Well, not lately.
Not lately, no. Anywho,
talking about that, just before we move on, have we heard back about our potential chat with the minister?
No, we haven't. I think I was just thinking about that today. I'm going to email him again and say, look, this is your last chance, you know.
Yeah, we're not going to. Yeah, and it's election day today, so I mean, I'd give it a couple of days
maybe
just in case there's maybe a few wounds needing licked. You know.
Oh, that does remind me actually a little bit of a news update. So I was at something, an event where Sarah Jahal talked about digital contact, and so that was really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember if I've said this, but she was saying that Linkmaker are going to trial. They're going to add on to their system. Digital letterbox contact, because that's a system that's in place across all the LEAs, and that's trial now, and with a hope and aspiration that it's set out before the end of the year. And also, Sarah Jahal is leading a group around maintaining lifelong contact, and that's looking at actually modernising practice. So that's really exciting. That is a thing that's going on behind the scenes.
It is, and I will say that I think that we're overdue with the digital contact thing.
Oh.
I think, again, it's language, isn't it? And, you know, nobody likes this letterbox terminology and all that sort of stuff. But I think there's been a couple of people who have kind of done pilots of this, isn't it? ARC adoption. Was it ARC?
Yeah.
Yes, they did one. Because I remember I was at a CVAA consortium of voluntary adoption agencies when I went to Adoption UK, their annual conference, and it was they did a presentation on it there, and I was so impressed with it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just a shame that, you know, they couldn't have, you know, just done something with it rather than, you know, no offense to Linkmaker, but, you know, it would be nice if it was kind of run separately to Linkmaker. But yeah
I know what you mean. I guess Linkmaker have got that infrastructure, haven't they? And they've got that relationship with all the RAs, which makes sense. But I guess the difficulty of one agency piloting it is that then you have to then duplicate that across a system. So,
well, this is true.
Yeah, so it's got to be a national system, hasn't it? Because in effect, people move and... Well, I guess, no, it doesn't, does it? By the nature of it being digital.
I'm thinking, because I'm just thinking there. I mean, like, if it's the case that... they are the ones that are going to run it, then obviously that means that I will have to use Linkmaker. And when I say have to, I don't mean grudgingly. I just mean that, you know,
sound
that,
like
I mean,
that.
I know, I did. No, that's fine.
Have you got beef with the guys down at Linkmaker?
No, I mean, I've worked with them. When I was at Adoption UK, they took on, they voluntarily, as a, I guess, a charitable kind of donation, they took on the Adoption UK forums when we built our new website, because there was no kind of there was no infrastructure to do the forums and to progress them. So the forums needed development and what have you, modernization, I think they call it. So I worked with them very closely. I'm just being, you know, it's Linkmaker to me is Linkmaker. So yeah, you know, whether we go all Meta or Meta on them and, you know, have different names for the different parts or what, I don't
might
know
do.
But might do, but let's, you know, I think my thing is all about terminology, really, because, you know, are we going to call it digital contact, because we're using that word contact, aren't we? And I cannot bear that word contact either. It should be,
can you not?
Like you say,
it doesn't bother me at all.
Well, it doesn't bother me, but it's like, it's just terminology, isn't it? And it's just like, you know, it's contact. Like, contact just in my head says every so often, rather than, you know, I think a digital platform should be as and when. So you can put a story on there, a little bit like Facebook, you know, you can put a story on there about how well they've done, you know, with their sats or some, you know, something that, you know, you might not remember to, I'm not saying you wouldn't remember sats, but I'm saying something you might not remember to put on in a 6 monthly letter or an annual letter kind of thing.
That reflects, you know, Charlotte Butler, who you spoke to on the podcast at the beginning of last year, Charlotte and Kerry. Charlotte did a really good blog about contact, and it was stuff like that that she sort of really highlighted, stuff, things like shoe sizes.
Yes.
Stuff that's is important, but could be overseen on, or seen as inconsequential. But for her, she said that stuff really matters, and it just... And again, it's really non-invasive stuff as well. You know, that adopters sometimes think, oh, what can I say? And you go, well, shoe size.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. And I think in this time that we live in, where technology is, you know, we're not going to be having, pardon me, but not going to be having 90-year-olds adopting young children who need to get used to the internet and all that sort of stuff. You know, people who are adopting are young, they use technology. It doesn't take 5 minutes to teach yourself one of these apps, or, you know, how to use Twitter or Facebook or what have you. So there's no reason why it can't work and really kind of develop the way we deal with this contact that we talk about into a way that actually will help everybody, really. You know, we know from speaking to people like Ruth Scott, and, you know, who had who facilitated contact between birth family and her children, and Charlotte and Kerry, who did the same, you know, that can work really well for them. Doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, for some it can work. So, you know, maybe this is a really good start in developing that and making sure that children get what they need from the relationships.
Yeah. And I think this group that Sergio Hall's pulling together under the sort of the banner of the Adoption Special Guardian Leadership Board, I think Sergio Hall is the very person who will be able to implement any sort of positive practice developments. Because again, it's just, it's the key. I know, looking at the podcast, if we got someone like Beth Neal on, or a fam, or adoptive parents or birth parents who were talking about contact and discussing it, there's a huge upswell in people listening. And engagement with those posts, and engagement with those podcasts, and it's something that is, it just really, really present, and it's never not important for families.
Yeah.
So that, I had to write an application to get on that group.
Oh, did you? Oh, I wish I'd known they were accepting applications. I would have made one.
No, I purposefully asked them not to send one to you in case you revived for the same job. So he's very poorly, very, very poorly. He probably won't even know you are. He forgets everything.
Oh, no, Sarah Joao was on a documentary that I watched. And sure. It's a really interesting documentary as well, actually. You about should adoption. Watch it. I'll send a link to you. Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Back when she was young and a social worker. Anyway, that's a total in-joke, that, isn't it? We shouldn't... Yes. We can't share that until the very last episode when we're going to spill all the beans.
Yeah, before we die.
Yeah, I did get a message of someone saying, you're saying Al Coates is not your real name. No, Al Coates is my name. Someone going, the whole premise of the podcast is now destroyed because you're not Al Coates. Al Coates is my name. It's what my mother calls me. It's what everyone calls me. But it's not my... on my birth certificate, it's what my employer calls me. Everyone in my life calls me Al Coates.
Yeah, but that's, it's not what's on your bank card or your passport, is it?
Exactly.
Yeah,
a version of that anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's cryptic, and if you can guess, there's a prize.
Yeah, and if you want me to narrow it down for you, I can give you the name of a children's program and you can take it from there.
Oh, shit, your face. I've had that all my life. Anyway, that's all the prattle and banter out the way, though that was quite meaningful prattle and banter.
It was.
I'm conscious that this next section might be a bit upsetting for people, and so I'm going to do like a responsible grown-up trigger warning. We're going to talk a little bit about the recent case of Leland James Corkill, who was murdered in an adoptive placement. So if people aren't up for that, then please, you know, feel free to go on. I don't know.
Finish up.
Yeah.
And you'll hear us next time.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to go into too much. We're not going to go into the gory details because I don't think that's...
I mean, that'd be right. And it wouldn't be respectful, would it? Really?
No, and I am also conscious that the case is ongoing, but I think it looks like it's a done deal. I shouldn't say that about the legal justice system.
Well, I guess it depends on where you read your information, doesn't it? Some people have said that there's been admissions of guilt, and you know, we're not there, we don't know, so it's not fair for us to judge. But you know, given some of the evidence that's been released.
Well, the adoptive parent has pleaded guilty to manslaughter, hasn't she? But the issue is whether it was murder or not. So it's kind of a tech. Well, that's a definition. So she's not. Yeah, I mean, so it's the story of a little boy who's placed in a fostering to adopt placement with a mum and a dad who'd presumably gone through the. Yeah, well, they have to. They've gone through the approval process.
Yeah, they will have done. Yeah.
So I saw, I mean, that's maybe my start point. I mean, the first thing is, of course, this is an absolute tragedy. So, you know, we're going to do our best not to kind of be flippant at all about it, because I think it's, I don't know about you, but I started to read it. So it's the story of it. I started to read it and I felt like I'd been punched in the stomach.
I always do when these cases come through, because, you know, what are we on, 1, 2, 3 a year at the minute?
Well,
and they're just hard. They're so hard to.
I think there's something like, is it? I can't remember the statistics, but there's a couple of hundred children a year killed, murdered. But only occasionally do they come up to the level of hitting the national media. But if you dig around deep enough, you see that this is going on all the time.
Yeah.
But I think the key thing about this is that it flips the narrative, doesn't it? Because it's, you know, often we see adopters are seen as the guardian, you know, the white horses, the saviors. Yeah. And then it's flipped because they've then become these totally opposite figures. And I was just reading through it. It's it reads as a narrative of a couple not coping from the outset.
Yeah.
So from placement, and there's the recording of their text messages where they're calling. The father's been charged, the adoptive father's been charged with kind of not failure to protect. The mum has got, there's accounts of her messages to him saying, oh, this kid, and what I'm going to do to this kid. And but not in a, it just reads as people not struggling. I'm not, I don't want to sound like, I'm apologising for
them. Do you know what it reads to me like, is that they weren't prepared for, you know, I mean, this is a 12-month-old. We're talking about. We're not talking about a 3-year-old or a 4-year-old. We're talking about a 12-month-old. You know, potentially only just walking. You know, maybe by couple of weeks or something like that. So it just strikes me that, you know, compared to, I'm not dismissing maybe some of the challenges they had or whatever, and I'm not sticking up for them at the same time. But all I'm saying is that, you know, I don't think many of us realize what we're getting into when we have a child that isn't ours placed with us.
Yeah.
I think it's a really difficult thing to do on reflection. But at the time, you know, when you're going through the process, when you're going to become that parent and you're like, yes, this is what I want, and et cetera, et cetera. But you just don't realize, the lack of sleep. You don't realize, you know, how much work it is actually to keep a child occupied during the day. And at 12 months old, that's going to be, you know, a 12-month old is going to be almost like, well, not necessarily just a newborn, but, you know, my great niece is 12 months old. And it's full on, you know, and her mum, you know, is a busy lady, as in busy being a mum.
Yeah.
And it just strikes me that some of the messages that you can, you know, if you go into any kind of media thing about this story, you know, some of the messages that they sent back and forward, the baby was 12 months old, you know, it just doesn't read in a way that you would expect for a 12-month-old's parents. You know, you would expect to be busy. So, but some of the behaviours may have been a little bit out of the ordinary, but I can't see for a 12-month-old that it's going to be anything like maybe the terrible twos or, you know, a 7-year-old who beats you back black and blue kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, like you said, the behaviour could reflect a child who's moved into a new home in a straight, you know, move from familiar place to an unfamiliar place.
Yeah.
You know, it is a difficult, adverse experience moving from foster care into an adoptive home. Mm. And I read them and it was really interesting because as a student social worker, we often go through serious case reviews. So this isn't a serious case review. So a serious case review occurs, the local children's safeguarding board in the local authority where a child dies in sort of suspicious or abusive situations undertakes a full review. So there will be a serious case review on this, but it will happen after the legal case, so it doesn't prejudice the legal case, and it'll
call
the conclusion. And we did that. We went through a couple of cases. One which was the Victoria Climbia case, which again I would totally say do not read that unless you are in the right frame of mind. It's not light reading at all. But there's obviously the baby Peter, which again was in the news today about the mum being released. But that's another story. And what is interesting, and I remember going on some training, and what is interesting is the question naturally is, well, how could someone murder a child? Or how could, or not necessarily even before that, how could someone start to talk about a child in this way? Because, you know, they're calling him name, and like mum saying he's a this and he's a that. And he very clearly stops being a child. He's like a manifestation. He's an embodiment of how crap everyone's feeling. And that was the training I went on, talking about how children can become sort of like talismans of people's woes, and they stop becoming children. Because they, you know, 3 months before this, they'd gone through, or whatever, you know, a few months before this, they'd gone through the approval process, and, you know, all the questions all the questions you were asked and I was asked, which is, you know, what would you do if a child did this, and are you prepared, and all of that stuff. But they've gone to a very altered, different place. Because I think, we don't know, but I can't imagine that there's no malice. You know, they didn't wake up in the morning and go, I know what we'll do. We'll adopt and then we'll kill a kid.
Yeah.
Surely.
Top, no. Yeah.
That seems really unlikely that people... Why would people have that as an end goal?
Yeah.
Why would anyone have that as an end goal? Now, there will be some people in exceptional circumstances. So how does a couple, how do they get from being people who wanted to have a child turn into people who would talk about a child like that, or stand by and watch someone else talk about a child like that, and then to a point where that child is then harmed to the point where they die? You know, murder or manslaughter, we'll find out. The truth will out.
Yeah.
That's a really complicated question, isn't it?
Yes. And I just when you were talking there, and I'm thinking about the time scales as well with this. I mean, I don't know how long the child, the little boy was with them, but
August we're looking at to January.
Okay, so their potentially approval date was within restrictions, lockdown.
Yeah.
You know, was there a home visit? I mean, I'm assuming there would be before a child was placed with them. Was it all, you know, was it remote, yeah, kind of online like we're doing right now, you know, to do this majority of the assessment, you know? Did the, I'm not blaming social workers here because obviously they're not the people that have done it, but, you know, is this indicative of the situation that we were all in at that time as well, where, you know, a lot of things were done online?
Yeah.
And is there questions around that as well? I don't know. But, well, you know, clearly it might have contributed in some way.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. And I think that you, I mean, I'm a social worker, so naturally I have like a huge amount of empathy. But some of the stuff, you know, that social workers are saying, you know, the mum's reported to say, I don't love him, or I don't feel like I, yeah, love him. How many, mm-hmm, new adoptive parents have said that?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, you know, we hear, well, we see it and hear it every day, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, did you feel, you know, did a light switch go on in you and you felt overwhelming love for your kids?
Yeah, way before I even met them. Right. That, I mean, that's, you know, that was our kind of experience, but I get it's not for, not everybody feels that same way. Yeah.
I mean, I think I was, you know, in love with the idea of my kids, but when I met them, it was different. That sounds terrible. Mm. But that was, that to me, being honest, in the, yeah, sense of like, I read their, mm-hmm, I read their names, I read their profiles, and I kind of fell in love with them.
Yeah.
Met them, and that kind of love had to catch up.
Yes. Yeah, and that's probably exactly the same, but I just see it as that, yeah, I fell in love with them, you know, when I read about them, when I saw the videos, when I, you know, and... Maybe there is a difference. Maybe you're right. But it's not, you know, if they were being supported appropriately, then they would be able to talk to their support worker, you know, because I'm assuming it would have been a foster placement to begin with, where they'd have a fostering social worker. Would that be, I mean, I'm not really 100% sure on how this works.
Or so would foster been to able, adopt, you're approved as an adoptive parent who can foster. So the child, yeah, had firstly, the little boy, because they pushed back the decision to adopt, the panel did,
yes, yeah,
because they had concerns. So the little boy, mm-hmm, would have had his own allocated social worker who should have been visiting at least every 6 weeks. It's 42 days is the legal requirement, but most local authorities, yeah, do it on the 4 week mark, but, mm-hmm, in COVID, and that,
yes,
August through to January was the last wave, wasn't it? Do you remember when they were, mm-hmm, it was kind of, you're in different zones, weren't you? If you're in this zone, you can, and this one, you can't. And it,
yeah,
was just a chaotic kind of autumn, wasn't it? After a fairly relaxed summer. So maybe it was missed.
Maybe.
But they would have had their own social worker. It's a heartbreaking case, isn't it?
It's just, it is. Yeah, it is. And, you know, it's, I don't know.
For the birth family as well.
They're always hard to deal with, aren't they? They're always hard to, yeah, get your head around because, you know, who, like you say, who goes out of their way to kill a child? You know, nobody, we would hope, in this, yeah, life, unless you're a serial killer who, you know,
yeah, yeah,
does that sort of thing.
Differently.
Yeah, but, you know, the fact that there's social work involvement and, you know, it just strikes me that there was... potentially, actually, it's interesting just thinking about something that I just read there. You know, the family were in love with the boy, the child. So the extended family were really, mm, like madly in love with the child. So that would say to me that they'd met him and, you know, they'd spent time with him and stuff like that. But again, it's down to the support thing, isn't it? You know, who was supporting this kind of feeling of a child who, you know, wasn't what they expected, I guess, would be the right way to phrase it, rather than, you know, labelling them as, you know, being 12 months old and being a little, you know, naughty boy at 12 months old. You know, you can't, That's yeah. what I can't get my head around, I guess, is that the support that was there, if that's how they felt, then they should have been talking to social workers in the same way, or a similar way, and saying, look, you know, there's a risk here for this child if this continues, because we can't deal with his behaviours, or, you know, whatever it was that was going on.
Yeah. I mean, but
people who get into that state of mind, I guess, wouldn't then be able to do that sort of thing, you know. I guess they wouldn't be able to say that out loud. It's, you know, it's between the two of them, the mum and the, well, the carers.
Presumably, if the family fell in love with him, they would have highlighted if they'd knew as well, the wider family.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, so, you know, was this a secretive thing that happened, and, you know, behind closed doors and all that sort of stuff? You know, and in normal child abuse cases, that would be, you know, similar kind of thing, isn't it? So.
Yeah, and there's the whole disguise compliance thing. You know, I think that I'm conscious that often, and there was a really interesting thread on my Facebook page about this. Lots of people shocked, and palpably, viscerally shocked by it, but also having sort of quite interesting insights around the idea that I think that a lot of us, like you had to fight to get to the point of adoption. You know, you've worked really hard. You're not worked really hard, but you've gone through the process. You know, you're kind of, it's a culmination of a lot of time and effort and energy, and you've brought a lot of family and friends with you, and you get to this point, and the child moves in, and you're meant, everyone then goes, you got what you wanted, and if it's not, you know, if it's not all peachy, then you're not, you feel you are then isolated, because you think, I can't tell people I'm not happy, or I'm not enjoying it, or I'm not coping. So that adds into it, and also I kind of feel massively for the birth family, and I feel massively for the social workers. Just awful.
Birth family, you know, having your child removed is hard enough, whatever the circumstances, but then to have that, you would feel blamed. You would feel the blame of losing your child once, but then losing your child permanently with no way back, you know, as a result of, you know, I'm not saying that they would feel this straight away, but as a result of, you know, having your child removed, they've been killed because they were removed from you and then placed with something else. That's just not something that, you know, definitely not. No.
So it's horrible. Pretty bleak. I mean, it is. It's interesting because I've had a few, you know, it's been an interesting few weeks in social work from around my parts and professionally, and just really quite, managing risk is just a really complicated thing, because you have, you know, we all have visceral reaction to threat and danger. And I'm just really conscious that we all respond to that differently. You know, I'm a very much wait and see sort of guy. You know, I'd rather wait than act incorrectly. But when children's lives are on the line, it's a really tricky. But the stakes are high everywhere. You know, if you remove him, you're potentially causing harm and trauma. You go, and I remember thinking, before I became a social worker, I remember thinking, oh, yeah, I'll do work in child protection. This is really easy. This is a really black and white issue. If children are being harmed, you remove them. and it sounds, you know, often when you read things with hindsight, you can see with 20/20 vision what was going on here. But no one, if anyone had known all of this stuff, they'd have acted. And I remember my first few weeks in my sort of practice placement, I had to do 100 days in a children and families team, just thinking, I'm not cut out for this. It seemed so clear before I was actually there in front of people, because some days, whatever happens, someone's going to get harmed. And it's trying to ensure that everyone's kept, this is murky, and I'm not, you know, I just realised that I'm not wired for that. I found it immeasurably difficult and complicated, so that's why I don't work in that particular field.
And you've just raised a really good point there about social workers as well, because, you know, no social worker would allow that to happen if they knew you know, that a child was going to be harmed or sadly killed, as is the case on this one. regardless of workload, regardless of, you know, lack of carers, regardless, because that child would have been removed straight away if they thought anything of the sort. And if they're not, then I'm sure it'll come up in subsequent reviews that will happen. But, you know, it's, and also, like you say, you know, this kind of thing about foster carers, adopters being, you know, I think probably more for adopters, because foster carers, like, are, you know, we've talked about allegations before, haven't we? It's less, we hear about them less with adoptive parents, but adoptive parents seem to be put on this pedestal of, so if you've gotten that far, that actually you're amazing. You've come forward, you're going to have this child for the rest of its life, and, you know, you are just the dog's bollocks for even coming forward in the first place. And I think that sometimes that's a kind of, you know, that's a misconception.
Yeah.
Sorry, my brain's just went to mush then. Yeah.
Your Duracells misconception have literally just gone.
Yeah, they've just burned out. But I think that is a misconception around that as well, because no, human after as well. And but this kind of the middle class discussion about adopters, you know, all adopters are middle class, or they're very intelligent, or, you know, they've got money, or they're this, or they're that, or the next thing. They're kind of two levels above where the birth parents would be. And I think that some adopters actually put themselves on that kind of pedestal as well, when in actual fact they bloody well shouldn't, because, you know, parents are parents. It doesn't matter how much money you've got, or how much, you know, this you've got, that you've got, the next thing. At the end of the day, a child is a child, and, you know, they need certain things. So I think that people do tend to do that. I'd hope that social workers don't, you know, but, you know, who knows? I can't answer that.
I mean, again, I think, I don't know, we're slightly off point, but I think that the voices of social workers are just not present in the conversation.
That's the other thing, isn't it? I mean, you know, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago, didn't we? Where we, you know, we can't even get social workers to come on here.
No, so, I mean,
not social workers who are working day in, day out in fostering or adoption or special guardianship or whatever. We have specialist social workers who come in, so people who are qualified social workers, but
people
who've gone
books.
In to do something else. But yeah, so you're right. We don't have that kind of, you know, that opportunity to speak to them. You know, the social workers and the team manager are named there in one of the articles, you know, and I think it's probably right that names are known, but, you know, that puts them in a kind of position as well, where, you know, you can just imagine some quarters saying, well, you know, social workers are to blame for this. And yet again, social workers having to defend themselves because of something that happened, that's deeply unfair on everybody, you know, including the child.
I mean, absolutely, it's a failure all round, and yeah, it's just it's a really tricky one. I would love, we do have private correspondence with social workers, and even social workers who have put their heads above the parapet and, but have done it anonymously and not particularly I'm not taking up the invitation to come on. I mean, we like to think that there's some highfalutin reasons they probably just don't like us.
We probably used a word wrong in one podcast. The following week after they'd contacted us, they were like, nope, not doing that again.
Don't even go there about words and language. I don't know. I think that we've probably unpicked that, and maybe when the serious case review comes out, which might be next year, probably by the time it gets by this is done, and the serious case review, it would be interesting to maybe pick out, because they will point to opportunities, that they will point to learning opportunities and where practice could be amended.
Yeah,
which is pretty bleak. Anywho, so I don't want to end on a. Such a doer note.
No, 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 sorry, no. A doer note, as my granny would have said.
A doer note. Pass the shortbread, Scott.
So what's coming up, pal? What have we got to save the date for?
Oh, that's a good
point.
Let's
cheer ourselves up, because I think this is a really great opportunity today to say that when you were over, when you visited, we put a pin in the diary, didn't we, for a couple of things, but
15th.
Mainly...
15th of July and 25th of November. So the 25th of November is, it's like you're testing me, isn't it?
Yeah, that's me that's got the memory issues.
Yeah, and I'm just an idiot. 25th of November, we've got our third annual conference. Booyakasha, check out my car. Yeah. We got Sarah Jahal promised she'd come. She said, unless something else comes up, which was, I took, it was a really odd email.
Well, that's a bit rude, isn't it? That's a bit rude.
I said, someone's going to put you in it. Yeah, well, like, you know, your dog needs to get a pedicure or something. So Sarah Jahal's going to come on. That'll be fantastic. And we're working on a guest list, really, and we wanted to do something. We really enjoyed what we did last year, but definitely it'll be something that's kind of a bit innovative, a bit different, a bit, you know, and trying to get some voices of some people. We've got a few ideas of people, so if you get an email, it's because of that. And then in July, a kind of a practice day around challenging violent aggressive behaviour. We're going to do that again, really cheap as chips. An opportunity for people to come and learn some stuff and sort of develop practice. So that's a couple of things we're doing, but they'll be announced in fullness, the fullness of time.
Yes, and I think it's worthwhile just mentioning now so that agencies can pull their fingers out that the annual conference is going to be the same price, it's going to be the same deal. So expect those emails coming through. Because I'm slowly getting back into work, so
I'm laughing because every year you say how much, and I go, "Well, what did we do last year?" And you go, "Well, I don't know what we did last year."
And I remember this year, surprisingly.
Last year I couldn't remember what we did the year before. I know. Well,
what was the first year? I wasn't working, was I? So we were like really kind of heavy on the old kind of getting the places gone early on, and then last year we got 3 weeks before and we're like, oh my god, it's in 3 weeks, we forgot about it because I was working. This year we're going to be a little bit different. Yeah. Boom. this is our job. Well, it's my job
now. Sweatbands, this is part of mine.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
I want merch. Inflatable rubber rings, the whole shebang. Anywho, exactly.
So yeah, but we're looking forward to them. It's nice to have those dates in diary.
I'm shattered. Then, I'm going to have to go to bed soon.
It's past your bedtime.
It is. My last job of the day at 5 to 5, one of my foster carers rang me and said, I need 2 baby bottles. And she was in hospital. Oh. So I had to cycle. Because we all sat down and went, is it going to be easy to go by car or bike? And everyone went, London, 5 o'clock.
Yeah.
Go on your bike. Mm-hmm. Where they're all home. They all clocked out. And I'm cycling around the North.
Oh, charming,
London.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've cycled, I did an hour's cycling. So I feel very fit and I'm sure, so I need a nap now. Anyway.
Yeah, I'm sure you do. I do as well. I was out today in a photo shoot, so I'm very important.
What was your photo shoot for?
I'm not allowed to say because it's not been announced yet.
Are you going to be the new L'Oreal man or something?
For this face, you must be joking. No, all will be revealed. It's not really podcasty.
You're going to be the face of hemorrhoid cream for Ireland.
To be fair, my skin, since I've started rehydrating, is just fabulous. I've almost got the face of a 45-year-old rather than the 55-year-old. And I'm only 45. So.
Your hair's got such a lovely sheen, Scott. Natural oils.
That's because it gets limited washing due to the fact I still can't touch my head. Not because I can't touch it, but because...
It makes you go funny.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and actually, my friend who's over, who's a nurse, said it's absolutely normal to feel like that, even though it's not on the outside of the skull. A lot of people do have that kind of.
Don't touch it.
It's like when you have a scar somewhere on your body and you can't touch it. It's a similar kind of thing. So it's all good. Anyway, what a way to finish a podcast.
Yeah, yeah, and on that cheery note, and on that bombshell.
Oh, dearie.
Oh, bless your heart. Well, look after yourself and Bon Jovi.
Anjovi.